Accession number 10657. This is reel 10.
Major Lewis, Reel 10. Okay, I think you wanted to tell me something more about preparations for patrolling.
Yes. We've talked about the daylight patrols and the commerce raiding, but there was a great deal of night patrolling done at Gazala, and it was an eerie business leaving the safety of Strickland's post and striking out into the desert. More often than not, it was a pitch black night, and Only if you've been on a night patrol in no man's land can you know what it feels like with the ceaseless anxiety which accompanies every minute. Patrol orders used to originate from the orderly room every evening at 5 o'clock, when the officer or NCO chosen to command the patrol was ordered to retort to battalion headquarters. After being briefed by the adjutant and the IO with all the latest information about enemy movements, and we were very fortunate in having a very good intelligence officer named Dennis Neal, who plotted things extremely accurately and gave the patrols very accurate information. Then the patrol commander returned to the company area to select his men. He in his turn briefed the patrol, and while the company sergeant major arranged the issue of patrol boots, which were thick suede boots known as brothel creepers with rubber soles, and the checking of weapons and ammunition, the commander had to arrange details about transport to the outpost and liaison with the outpost platoon and the flanking units. There was a great deal to do. Many of the things seemed unimportant, but worded together they made a picture of a successful or an unsuccessful patrol. At last light, the patrol was taken out to Strickland's in 1,500 weight trucks. Once they arrived out there, contact made with the outpost commander.
To see where we got. From Strickland's outpost, some of the patrols went out on foot and others were driven to within 2 or 3 miles of their destination. They all had one thing in common. Once they left Strickland's post, they were on their own, and their lives depended on their own quick thinking and decisions. The safety of the box, sometimes not more than a mile or two behind them, might as well have been 100 miles away if the patrol fell foul of an enemy ambush. Navigation was by compass and the North Star. When the patrols had completed their task, they returned thankfully to Strickland's and the box in time for breakfast and a well-earned sleep. I think the point that has to be made here is that a patrol that went out by truck, when they left the truck and went forward, they had to make quite certain that a reverse compass bearing would bring them back to that truck again, because the truck didn't move. The truck stayed where it was, and if you missed it, you could go on walking, and you might, with luck, end up at your own outpost, or you might not.
You might go into a minefield.
You could do, which is exactly what happened on one occasion.
When the truck was left out on its own, how many men would be left with it?
Well, you'd leave the driver.
That was all.
I would have thought there would have been one other man left with him, actually, but certainly there was the driver. But it was very much a soft skin vehicle, and he was very vulnerable if there happened to be any enemy patrols in the area. This would have been at a later stage when they began to move in.
What was he supposed to do if the enemy did start
making
an appearance?
If the enemy did an appearance, I think that the odds, I doubt very much whether he would have stayed where he was. I think he would have taken off. in the direction of Strickland's. I can't actually ever remember that happening. I don't think we had any occasions when one of our own 1500 weight trucks was shot up after the patrol had left it.
Were the drivers, I mean, did they camouflage the trucks when they...
Well, this was at night, you see.
It's at night.
Yes, this was all these are night patrols, and it was pretty dark most of the time.
So any patrol going out in daylight would always be on foot?
Depends. In the early days, when the enemy were a good long distance away, they went a long way by truck. And I think they continued to go out by truck, even when they closed in, because it was still a commerce raiding operation. The patrols that went out at night really went out to plot enemy minefields where they were being built, and possibly to plot the exact location of something which could then be given to the intelligence officer to put on his map. So they were an entirely different sort of patrol that went out at night.
There'd be a stealth patrol then.
Yes. I mean, for instance, one patrol that I took out, in fact the last patrol to go out from the Gazala line, I had to take it out into the area where there'd been quite a fierce firefight the day before, and to search bodies and clothing and everything to get identification. That was the sort of thing that the night patrols used to have to do. Another thing, if, for instance, a tank or one of our trucks had been hit and was abandoned, they might try and get it back with a recovery section, or they might decide to blow it up. So quite a lot went on at night, but it was quite different to what went on during the day.
When you went out on that last patrol, did you find the enemy?
Didn't find any enemy, but I can tell you what we did. If you can switch it off just a sec. Oh. It was a B Company patrol, and I took it out to the area of a wrecked armoured car to obtain identification from the deserted enemy slit trenches. We left the outpost at 9 o'clock and returned at 5:15 the following morning, having thoroughly searched the Italian positions. No, we didn't find any enemy, but letters and documents which we removed from clothing in the deserted slit trenches provided valuable information for Dennis Neal, the battalion intelligence officer. During the firefight, the British artillery and the machine gun fire from the British tanks had caused heavy casualties to the Italians in the forward positions, and there were piles of blood-stained, discarded clothing, which told a grim story to the men of patrol. Some of the slit trenches had been caved in by the British tank. It was a lone tank which had broken through, having lost wireless control with the others, if I remember rightly. But several of the enemy had obviously been crushed to death as they sheltered in the trenches. And this was a patrol. We weren't sorry to get back to Strickland's post after that one. It was very unpleasant because we were there from 9 o'clock till 5:15, turning over bodies and sorting through clothing and that sort of thing. We weren't interrupted or interfered with by anybody.
You say you got documents and papers and so forth. Were they mainly official or were they personal?
No, mainly we were looking for things that would identify the unit. Like, for instance, some of them had little diaries that they kept, not very many, they weren't supposed to any more than our blokes were. But you might find something, a letter addressed to somebody from a particular town, which might tell you whether it was Trento or Brescia, because most of the Italian divisions, a lot of them had names of towns and cities. Trento was one, and Brescia was another one. So you usually were able to find something that Neil could get hold of and could make good use of.
Do you remember who they were? Did you hear who they were, these people you've been searching?
No. It all happened the day before. We weren't involved in the actual scrap the previous day.
I think it's worth mentioning, actually, that Neil and his intelligence sergeant, a man named Archie Bark, B-A-R-K, in the middle of June one day, they left Strickland's outpost at 9 o'clock at night, burnt cork on their faces, and their intention was to get as far as many tracks and cross to the other side and observe. And they, in fact, probed deeper than any other previous night patrol. They stayed out all the following day without moving until the following night, and then they went on with their observation, which was a pretty good effort. But that was Dennis Neal, our intelligence officer, having a look himself.
What sort of chap was he? Did you know him well?
Yes, he's still alive, actually. He's the... Dennis. He ended up as secretary of the Institute of Builders, I think. Not the sort of chap you would... very difficult to describe, a very quiet sort of bloke, but very efficient. And, I mean, what he would have done, he wouldn't have seen any danger, probably, about going out with Bark, because he would have treated the whole thing quite clinically. You know, it was something that had to be done to get a bit of information for his maps. And I don't suppose it ever occurred to him that he might be captured or taken prisoner or shot up or anything like that. He was a very, very sound bloke indeed, and certainly the best I heard the battalion ever had. Almost scholarly in his approach to things.
Was he a Durham man?
No. No, he wasn't. Not one of the original DLI.
Where was he from?
Dennis Neal, I don't know. I think he joined the battalion down in Honiton in Devon, when they came back from France, I think it was, in 1940. Something like that.
Had he been on a special course to fit him for the duties of intelligence officer?
Well, I think he would have been, yes, I would imagine so. I think he would have had to have been. You know, the three battalion IOs were all responsible to the brigade IO, who in turn was responsible to division and all that sort of thing. They were told what they'd got to do and what information was required, but I'm sure that they must have had some sort of training at some Middle East training centre or Geneva or something like that.
What about the corporal?
Corporal Bark.
Bark.
Archie Bark. Became an officer eventually. And died very soon after the war, actually, but he came through all right. But they made a very good team, Neil and Bark, absolutely first rate. But Neil is still alive, actually. He's coming up to the reunion the end of next week.
What was Bark's background and history?
He was a Scotsman. He got the MM, in actual fact, for his work with the patrols. And... a good navigator was really worth his weight in gold in the desert, and Bark was a very, very fine navigator. And he succeeded in getting several patrols back when they had become disoriented. He got them back to Strickland's because his back readings were absolutely 100%, you know. And he was a Scotsman, and I forget when he came to the battalion. He certainly wasn't another Durham man. He may have come with the Coyley or somebody like that, you know.
Were they the only two members of the intelligence section in the battalion?
No, there was another one. There was a man named Lance Corporal Oates, who on another occasion went out with a Major Drury of the 8th RTR, and they established an OP near the 69th Brigade outpost that had been captured by the Italians. They camouflaged themselves and prepared a hideout all night, and they lay out under the blazing sun all the following day. That was one of the big snags about being out in the open. If you were hiding up, you just had to lie in the sun. And, you couldn't do that for more than about one day. So there were three. I think there was Dennis Neal, Archie Bark, and Lance Corporal Oates.
Did you get a sort of regular flow of intelligence down from them, keeping you in the picture?
It wasn't too bad, actually, if I remember rightly. But there again, I think it depended a great deal on your own intelligence officer probing away and asking them what they'd got and saying, well, oh yes, I'm interested in that, don't keep that to yourself. And that was where you got a good IO, not only the action he was able to take, but the way in which he was to get stuff out of brigade. I think division and brigade were fed pretty well with intelligence, because don't forget, we were all in a box. It wasn't mobile. We knew where the Germans and the Italians were. We knew where our outposts were. We knew where many tracks were. And so it shouldn't have been too difficult to build up a fairly good picture of what was going on the other side.
Where did he keep his maps? Were they pinned
battalion headquarters?
They were all pinned up by you?
Yes. Well, I mean, he before you went out on... I mean, he made his own maps, in actual fact. And you would be shown these before you went out. So he went to quite a lot of trouble. If he couldn't get the message over another way, he'd draw a map, you know, do that.
Well, you say he made his own maps. Was he a cartographer? Or were these sketch maps which were provided?
Sketch maps, in actual fact. I mean, there is one in here. There's a photograph of one that he did of Alamein, actually.
What were your issue maps like?
I cannot remember, actually. I don't think there wouldn't have been... I can't think there would have been any issue maps. I mean, what could they tell you, really? Except that the Mediterranean's there, the coast road is there, and they might have marked a few beers or something like that. But there would be very little on them.
Contours, possibly.
Yes, I don't think so, because there wouldn't have been all that. I mean, you've got the odd hillocks and things, but there wouldn't have been any... And the escarpments up near the coast. But we weren't up near the coast. We were down at that particular time. I really can't remember. I'm sure I would remember if we'd have had maps that were any use, like Ordnance Survey or something. I don't think we did. The Bir Hakeim garrison retired during the night of June the 10th and 11th. It was impossible after June the 9th to get any more supplies through to the garrison. There was a big tank battle going at El Adam, the El Adam Akroma area. However, 50 Div and the 1st South African were still holding the northern sector of the Gazala line and continued to strike when possible.
But it was the fall of Bir Hakeim, was it, that
that was a lot
led to the breakout?
It did, really, yes. Sometimes people did get into our own minefields. Well, after one particular action, Lance Corporal Archer of the 8th Battalion, who was a pre-war stock-bought footballer, had to take back to the Strickland's outpost some wounded South Africans from a knocked-out armoured car. And he was told to make for Strickland's on a due north bearing, checking his direction with the next green very light signal due to go up from the outpost in 20 minutes. This particular operation, the outpost commander fired a very light signal as a sort of guide. The rest of the patrol, having sent Archer off, went back to Strickland's, and they got there at 2:30. The patrol commander was very surprised to find that Archer's truck had not arrived. What had happened? Was that Archer, instead of making for Strickland's post, bypassed it and set his course for the box in order to get the wounded men back quickly.
His truck went right through the Czech minefield between Strickland's post and Petro's post, and eventually ran into the main minefield protecting the box, not far from Auckland Gap. When the truck went over the minefield wire, the driver made frantic efforts to stop, but it was too late. The truck blew up on a mine. Archer and the driver were killed. Two of the private soldiers in the back of the truck with the South Africans were wounded. The shock killed the dying South African immediately, although his companion survived. It was a tragic ending to the night patrol. But one has to appreciate that to find your way in a truck through the pitch darkness of a desert night, one understand how easy it was for Archer to make the slight navigation error during the 4 mile journey which took the truck into the minefield, only a few yards from the Auckland Gap, which was a gap that didn't have any mines in it. So it was a tragic business, really.
How wide was that Auckland Gap then?
About the width, 1.5 widths of a 3-ton lorry, something like that. Yeah. Now then, following that, the patrol that I took out, which was the last patrol from the Gazala line, the following morning, 50 Div was ordered to withdraw from Gazala, from the Gazala line that night. That was the night of July the 13th, 14th. But morale was very high in the battalion. And they didn't, you know, the battalion certainly didn't want to withdraw. We thought we could cope perfectly well with the Germans. But the trouble was that the battle behind the Gazala line had gone very badly for the 8th Army. And Ritchie, General Ritchie, didn't want the South Africans and 50 Div surrounded and destroyed piecemeal, as had been the case with 150 Brigade. So that was really the finish of the Gazala line, and I think the people who came out of it extremely well, quite apart from the intelligence section, were the carrier platoon, who over a period, during that period in the Gazala line, really turned themselves into a highly efficient fighting force with their commerce raiding activities, destroyed a large number of enemy transport, captured a lot of prisoners, and really justified their existence in more ways than one. And I think they put up a remarkably good show, because they were basically soft-skinned vehicles to an anti-tank gun or to an armoured car. That's the finish of Gazala, apart from the breakout. Fighting withdrawal from Gazala.
The breakout from Gazala.
Yes, the breakout. It was going to be a fighting withdrawal for 50 Div. The idea was to attack westwards, to smash a way through the German and Italian forward positions, then through their lines of communication. 50 Div would then wheel south, deep into the desert, then east to a rally point at Fort Maddalena on the Egyptian frontier. It was a daring, a spectacular operation, and in every way a fully mobile attack. And that was the first of several fully mobile attacks that the 8th Battalion were due to carry out. Now, my company, which was B Company, I was with B Company, a platoon commander, and we were with Jake Jackson, the CO. I have to say that we didn't fire a shot that night, in actual fact. Jackson had a charmed life at that time, Jake Jackson, and we all reckoned that with him, with our column, we stood a pretty good chance of getting through. The same couldn't be said about other columns of the 8th Battalion, who had a pretty rough time, but we didn't do too badly at all.
So you didn't actually run into any substantial enemy forces?
Not substantial, no. I mean, we just drove flat out. And did what we were supposed to do, drove through where their forward positions were, so you had to avoid the slip trenches and everything. It wasn't entirely uneventful, but very little happened to us.
What happened to all the minefields and the wire and the other?
Well, we went through our own minefield gaps, and so far as they were concerned, they hadn't laid anything like the size minefield that we had. I mean, it was hardly worth their while, really. What it would have done, it would have protected many tracks. They did lay a few minefields, but there was nothing like the large minefields that surrounded the Gazala box. Say a few words about what happened to B Company, if you like, here. It's simply the main force, which was commanded by Colonel Jackson, the CO, with B Company as the infantry element, didn't fire a shot that night. It was dark when the column moved off from the outpost, and the vehicles were closed right up, nose to tail, as they crawled along in bottom gear. By the time the bridgehead area was reached, a lane had already been cleared by the flanking columns, and the trucks halted whilst Colonel Jackson checked up on the situation. They remained in position astride the bridgehead until about 2 o'clock in the morning, when a welcome message was received from the brigade commander to disengage and continue the advance. The withdrawal of 151 Brigade, that is the three Durham battalions, and divisional units through the bridgehead had been completed, and the CO sent out the code word Benghazi. Then he gave the order to move off south into the desert. What did happen was that as the vehicles weaved about, bypassing abandoned trucks which had been set on fire and giving a wide berth to local skirmishes, most of them felt that somehow they would get through. As one of them said afterwards, whether it was Jake's luck or the IO's navigation, we safely rounded Bir Hakeim and turned east towards the Egyptian frontier wire.
So what sort of speed would you be going if you were...
Fairly, well, not all that fast. It was pretty bumpy in parts, you know. And, I mean, I think it was... It wasn't a sort of flat desert where you could change into top gear and bowl along. So I suppose you'd be crawling along at about 15, 20 miles an hour most of the time.
How would you actually be able to see the vehicle ahead? Did they carry any sort of shaded lights or anything like that?
No. It was rather like the convoys at sea, I think. You know, you've just got to keep your eyes open. I remember, I'm not sure whether it was... It must have been after one of the Mirza Matruh breakouts that we followed a gunner truck on the way back into Mirza Matruh. And there was a chap's hand hanging out of the back of the truck. Have I told you this before? I have. But it was uncanny, really, because I couldn't wait until we stopped to find out who it was or what had happened to him, because he was dead, but his hand was hanging out of the back of the truck the whole time, in front of us, you know, about, I suppose, where that tree is over there. But it had to be a fairly slow progress. Because of the slip trenches and things. And, of course, at a later stage, Matruh, there were mines involved as well.
How long were you at Matruh before you had to break out of there?
Well, that's quite a... not a complicated thing, but quite a lot happened to us here. Chapter B, can it reject me from there? 50 Div moved back to Bir el Talata on the afternoon of June the 17th. the remnants of the 8th Battalion assembled in a brigade camp. We lost something like 71 other ranks, not accounted for, during the breakout of the battalion, but that was not in our column. And to Brookfell the following day, June 21.
Did that news get through to you, that Tobruk had fallen?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think that's the sort of thing that would have... we would have known that, I think.
What happened to these 71 missing?
Well, at that time, they weren't accounted for. You know, it's an extraordinary thing, but after every battle, you always have what looked to be pretty horrible figures. And then maybe days, weeks afterwards, people begin to turn up, coming from different directions. They've got themselves attached to some other unit or brigade or something, or been given a lift in a gunner truck coming out of Gazala. They come back again. So although it looks bad always the following morning when you do a count, because that's the very first thing you do, it does improve a little after that. I suppose there would have been a final count as to what we lost coming out of Gazala, but the only information we've got was just that the following morning there were 71 not accounted for.
Were they mostly men who'd just gone missing because they'd lost the way?
Not necessarily. I think that, I'm quite certain that some of the trucks probably ran into slit trenches and became immobilised immediately, and maybe they got shot up in there or something. You'd have to...